In the fall of 1986, Ronald Reagan found himself at the center of a massive scandal that looked like it might bring down his presidency. It became known as the Iran-Contra affair.
The things that happened were so bizarre and insane, I can't begin to tell you.
Please do.
To hear the whole story, listen to Fiasco, Iran-Contra, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, it's David Greene, and I would like to welcome you to Left, Right, and Center. I'm with Sarah Isger, who is here on the right. Moa Lathy is here on the left. And Sarah, I am sorry for your loss in March Madness. You wanted Houston. You called it. They got so close.
They didn't even, it's you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
That's true. But I mean, what a wild ride.
Lesson.
Like, beat Duke when it looked like they had it lost, and then lost to Florida when it looked like they had it won. That's, yeah. So you were as wrong as me and Mo in predicting the national champion. Let's just leave it at that.
No, not as wrong. No.
there's no trophy in this group for second place. Well, speaking of wild rides, I wanted to talk about our politics, which has been kind of insane. What else is new? President Trump's tariffs on much of the world, I mean, including islands with a penguin population and no humans, actually went into effect. The markets collapsed. And then we had this extraordinary turnaround this week. Trump hit pause on most of the aggressive tariffs for 90 days. There's still a 10% tariff on most countries. The markets shot back up, though they still appear shaky given the uncertainty. But President Trump celebrated the market rebound. And he's also been bragging about world leaders who he says have been coming to him and asking, can we please negotiate this?
I'm telling you, these countries are calling us up, kissing my ass. They are dying to make a deal. Please, please, sir, make a deal. I'll do anything. I'll do anything, sir. And then I'll see some rebel Republican, you know, some guy that wants to grandstand, say, I think that Congress should take over negotiations. Let me tell you, you don't negotiate like I negotiate. Congress takes over negotiating. Sell America fast because you're going to go busted.
His swagger aside, Sarah, I wondered, you recently talked about struggling to figure out what the best case scenario was. Like, even if Trump got what he wanted in this whole tariff craziness, what would the best case scenario be? Are we seeing a possible best case scenario here? Is there a world where there are new trade deals that fulfill his goal of protecting American manufacturing and don't badly harm American consumers, if that's where we're headed?
I still don't understand the best option coming out of this. So he changed the tariffs so that now it's 10% across the board, except for China, Mexico, and Canada.
And China's like 4,000% or something like that. I mean, it's,
yeah, I mean, we've stopped counting numbers that high. But I'm confused because, like, we didn't get anything out of having those higher tariffs except a stock market crash. And we taught the world that we're unreliable. And we taught our manufacturers that we're unreliable. So if you were thinking of starting a manufacturing company here in the United States, why would you invest right now when the future is so uncertain? He had tariffs, so it made sense to invest. And then a few days later, he doesn't have tariffs. So maybe it makes some sense to invest, but less sense to invest. We don't know what next week is going to hold. We still don't know whether this is about negotiation or if it's about restructuring the American economy to have more manufacturing here rather than sort of those countries that have shown a competitive advantage for, you know, for instance, making Nike. So I still don't know what we're doing. I still don't know why we're doing it. And I don't know what the best case scenario is because I don't have the answers to those other two questions. What I do have is a lot of rage in my heart for that clip that you just played where he said Congress should have no role in setting tariffs when the Constitution, in fact, only gives Congress a role in setting tariffs, so that the president doing this, either Congress didn't give the president authority to set these tariffs, and there's a great argument for that, that under IEEPA, the emergency powers that he's claiming, says nothing about tariffs, so that'd be a really big deal for Congress to give away its tariff power and not actually ever say that. It just says you can sanction countries in a national emergency, but this is about revenue, not sanctions, right? So Congress didn't give the power to the president in the first place. And if they had given the power to the president in IEPA, it would arguably make IEPA unconstitutional because Congress can't give away its legislative, its core constitutional legislative power to the president. So either way, the president's clip is not only wrong, it's aconstitutional and deeply, deeply upsetting to me as someone who believes that the separation of powers is how we keep this whole train running.
Well, I do want to get to Congress's role or lack of in all this. But Mo, let me just ask you, I've been thinking a lot about what David Axelrod, you know, veteran Democratic strategist, has been saying as he's watched Trump do all this. I mean, Axelrod said on CNN that Trump created this crisis, then tried to take credit for the market rally. He's saying that Trump thinks that he can sell his own narrative, and he predicted on social media that basically what's happening is that Trump was staring down the barrel of economic disaster, and now he's going to strike a series of mostly unremarkable bilateral trade deals, but declare them the greatest of all time. That sounds pretty Trumpian, yeah. Believable. Is that what you're seeing here?
Just like he did when he negotiated the trade deal with Canada and Mexico in his first term. Right? Where he said this was the greatest trade deal ever, the one that he negotiated. But now he's talking about how we have a terrible trade deal with Canada and Mexico. It's his own deal.
Right.
So, you know, you'll have to excuse me when he sits there and talks about how he's the greatest negotiator in the world. If he was such a great negotiator, he wouldn't have negotiated a deal that he now says is so terrible. But look, here's the reality, right? I mean, this is so bad on so many levels, but not the least of which is today, Americans have less money in their pockets, less money in their retirement accounts, period. Even though he rolled back the uber super aggressive tariffs against most of the world, we still have the highest tariff level now under Donald Trump than at any point, which means prices have already started to go up. We've seen the stock market go down. Sure, it rallied when he rolled back the super duper aggressive tariffs, but that same day, it still closed worse off. The next day, it started worse off. And overall, even with the rally, the stock market was worse off than it was before he even started this whole exercise. And that has real impacts on real people. Sarah's right. Not only have we lost the trust of our friends across the world, who now are like, we're going to have to do business with the United States, but like, he's going back on his own last trade deal. Why should we trust him with a new one? But most importantly, he's losing the trust of manufacturers, of farmers. His numbers on the economy are the weakest they have ever been. People are feeling chaos. And when it comes to the economy, that is the last thing people want to feel, is chaos.
Well, and among the people who seem to be freaking out, I mean, we've started to hear Republicans in Congress going public, surprisingly, with some of their concerns. This was before the Trump reverse course, but I want to hear a couple of GOP voices here.
At the end of the day, in my view, if the outcome from these tariffs is really high tariffs from every country on earth against American goods, and really high tariffs from America against goods from every other country on earth, that is going to be really bad for Texas and really bad for America.
You think about it, tariffs, or no matter who does them, they're just interventions by government. They restrict the freedom of people and businesses. I believe the lower tariffs on both sides, the better.
I mean, Ted Cruz of Texas saying this could be really bad for Texas and really bad for America. And then you have John Kennedy from Louisiana saying that this restricts the freedom of people and businesses. How significant is it that we have two Republican senators who are calling out Trump? I mean, is this a moment?
not significant enough, but I'll take it, right? My friend David French compared it to the dramatic scene in a movie where, you know, someone's in the hospital and they sort of say their last words and the heartbeat machine goes flatline and you hear nothing and everyone stares and seconds go by and then you hear beep. Like, that's all that was.
It's very dramatic, Sarah. That's really...
It was a single solitary beep on
from
the EKG.
From the Republican, from congressional Republicans, like they're...
Hell, from the entire Senate, just like from Congress, that maybe they have some role to play here and that they should provide input on this. Remember, the Constitution actually says Congress is the only one with the power to set taxes and duties. Duties meaning tariffs.
Right.
So...
Doesn't feel like that's happening.
Where have
right
you been?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad they said something at all. I wish that we had a more robust Congress that thought their jobs were to propose, debate, and vote on legislation rather than to tweet, sit on cable news, and raise money. But, you know, you go to war with the army you have.
Mo, I mean, Trump did say to reporters, I thought people were jumping a little out of line. They were getting yippy and a little bit afraid as part of his explanation for why he reversed course. I mean, is that Trump's way of saying, uh-oh, Republicans are starting to say this is not good?
No,
how do you interpret yippy?
No, he's not talking about Republicans, right? He's still attacking these Republicans. He's still going out there and attacking Republicans for quote-unquote grandstanding, and they just need to get on board, Republicans in Congress. No, he's talking about the markets and all of his corporate CEO buddies who are...
They were getting yippy.
Who were with him up until, you know, quote-unquote Liberation Day, and then started freaking out along with everybody else. I mean, even his best friend Elon Musk was out there attacking the tariffs, and primarily by going
best
after...
Best friend for now, after this right? tariff thing, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's what he's talking about. Now, the whole thing was ridiculous. Watching his administration, the Secretary of the Treasury, his White House press secretary... his deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, all out there immediately following the reversal saying, see, this was his plan all along. The White House press secretary going out there and saying to reporters, you clearly didn't read Art of the Deal if you don't understand what he's doing. And literally hours later, the president comes out and pulls the rug out from under his own people. They don't know what they're doing over there because he doesn't know what he's doing over there when it comes to this. He's trying to strike this tough posture that he's taking on the world and putting America first. And that's what his entire campaign was about. But it's been really bad. And it's further isolated us. And it's taken money out of your pocket and money out of your retirement account. He knows that's not sustainable. And so now he's just kind of flailing, trying to contain both the political and the economic damage.
We've mentioned this sort of vaguely and at different points over the course of this podcast together. If I took off his name and took about half of his policies, Donald Trump's presidency would be indistinguishable from a Democratic president, you know, campaign promises circa like 1985 to 2000, roughly. And when you ask Democrats about the tariff, they get really stuck on this, right? Because like, they're not the free trade side. And a reporter this week asked Hakeem Jeffries why Democrats weren't coming out just saying like the tariffs are bad, and whether it was muddying Democrats' message to have to kind of be like, well, I know we said we were for tariffs, but we didn't mean these tariffs, and there's a way to do it, but this isn't the way to do it. And Jeffries was like, yeah, this is tough because basically he's doing our policies, but we have to be against him. And these I just find it very annoying and frustrating that we've talked about the horseshoe theory of politics. But a lot of people online are saying like, oh, the two parties have switched positions. No, they haven't. It's just that the Republican Party is now where the Democratic Party was. And the Democratic Party has maybe continued to move a little bit on some other issues. But we do not have a free trade, limited government, liberal, you know, in the Western European conservative sense, liberal party anymore in this country. And this is really bad.
Mo, let me take a quick break, and then I'm going to bring you in to talk about what Sarah just said. We will be back with more Left, Right, and Center in just a moment.
Imagine if every person in Texas, New York, and Florida suddenly lost their home. That still wouldn't equal the 120 plus million people who've fled war and persecution. Right now, the UN Refugee Agency is responding in 136 countries. But as violence escalates, your help is needed. Donate today and critical relief will reach a refugee family within 72 hours. While we can't rebuild their home overnight, your gift will provide food, shelter, and hope for the future. Go to unrefugees.org/donation to make your gift.
All right, we're back with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy talking about tariffs. And Sarah, you were just making the point that if you took away Donald Trump's name, this could be some of the very arguments for tariffs, protecting manufacturing and so forth that we heard from Democrats in the 80s and in other times.
And just to be clear, if we're actually going back to the 80s, then keep his name because he was a Democrat in the 80s too. But whatever. Yeah,
but hold on. I think where I'm going to take issue with you, Sarah, is like you're applying that to this case. That's not this case. At no point have Democrats ever said, go with these global crazy tariff schemes against every country in the world, including countries that we've got a trade surplus with, like Australia. At no point has that ever been the Democratic Party's position. Yeah, back in the 80s and the 90s, Democrats would say, let's have some targeted tariffs. And you know what? There are a lot of Democrats out there right now saying if the president had done this strategically, if the president had gone out there and done some targeted tariffs and negotiated some specific deals, sure, maybe we could be on board with that. Remember, there were a whole lot of Democrats who actually supported the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement that he negotiated in the first term because they thought that NAFTA was screwing the American worker. So, which again was a trade deal that was negotiated by a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. So a lot of Democrats were on board with his approach to trade and tariffs in the first term. But this has never been a Democratic position that we're just going to go with this scattershot approach that's just going to blow up the entire global trade system. That's never been who we are.
But can I ask, I mean, and Sarah, you said stipulated on that, that these are not the exact tariffs that Democrats were talking about. But like, I think back to the whole discussion during President Trump's first term about putting pressure on NATO countries to pay more for, you know, what NATO does, that the United States was kind of being stiffed and taking on too much of the responsibility. There was a massive freak out, which I think was justified because the idea of the United States breaking with NATO is terrible. We're still seeing that play out right now, deeply concerning. But there are some who at the end of the day said, huh, like if this caused some countries to pay up more and contribute more of their military budget to NATO to make it more fair, that wasn't a bad thing. And I guess, Mo, this is my question when we think about best case scenario here. I mean, let's say after all this mess, the market tumbles. And I agree with you, like, we need to note that people have less money today in their retirement. It's particularly concerning for older Americans. That said, is there a long view here where if we settle into some trade deals that end up being what Democrats were arguing for in the 80s and 90s, like that's where we land and Trump just sort of caused all this chaos as an opening negotiating move? Is that possible?
How much pain do we have to suffer to get there when we could have just done it the right way in the first place? The president had just said, let's sit down with the 5-10 countries that I think are the worst offenders out there and negotiate new deals with them and impose tariffs on them until they do. I think you would have a very different reaction out there. But that's not what's happening. There's going to be tremendous short-term pain. There's not only are we losing our prices going up, when remember his number one campaign promise was to bring prices down. Not only do we have less money in our in our retirement accounts. He's now threatening tariffs on pharmaceuticals. Yeah, there's nothing grandma and grandpa want less than uncertainty over how much their prescription medication is going to cost next month and whether that'll be different than the month after. We're going to be facing a lot of pain. And let me give one example, an example that I don't think is getting a ton of attention right now. Let's talk about the shipping industry, right? I was talking to a friend who lives in San Diego. This administration imposed a new rule on shipping companies that says, if you have a single ship in your fleet that was produced in China, anytime you come into an American port, you have to pay, on top of the tariffs, a $1 million fee.
Just because the ship was produced in
China.
Just
because the ship was produced in China. You could have 14 other ships that weren't, but if you have one, you now have to pay this $1 million fee before when you come into one of our ports. Well, if you're one of those companies, because every major shipping company has at least one ship produced in China, rather than going to San Diego, you can just go up the coast to British Columbia. So now the people who work at the Port of San Diego are screwed. Let's take it one step further. You can say, well, I get it. He's trying to say screw China and build more ships in the United States. There's only two places in the country that can produce these types of commercial vessels, San Diego and Philadelphia. And both of those shipbuilders have exclusive contracts with the U.S. Navy. So we can't right now, which means we have to build more factories to produce these commercial ships. You know what the runway is to be able to do that? 20 years. So we're going to lose jobs, telling people, sorry, there are no more containers coming into the ports of San Diego or Philadelphia. So we're going to have to lay off, but come back in 20 years when we'll have new jobs for you. Are we really willing to take that kind of pain so that he can eventually land in the place you were talking about, David, when he could have just started in that place in the first place? That's why I think his numbers on the economy are starting to tank.
Two responses to that. One, I think Mo just made a brilliant argument for the conservative case on free trade. So thanks for that. No need for me to repeat any of that.
Sometimes we can agree on things.
I'm just saying you're disagreeing with the traditional Democratic side, and it's a glorious moment for me. Second, I think part of your question, David, is whether we're willing to acknowledge that there's a problem underlying the U.S. economy, and whether we think that Donald Trump's diagnosis of that problem is correct, and then whether we think his solution to the diagnosis, to the problem is correct. I think Mo and I are in strong agreement, and you as well, and well, the majority of Americans, that the prescription is incorrect. But where I think a lot of people start disagreeing, and it's a much more interesting conversation, is whether there is a problem. Most people seem to say yes, but what is the diagnosis for what that problem is, right? Donald Trump's is about the net export versus import issue. And like, that's weird. That's not in my top 100 list of things that are wrong with the US economy right now. If you just have some weird nostalgia for like the 1950s, and then you look and say like, well, we had different export and import numbers. Like, okay, there was also different rainfall that year. Like the rain didn't cause this either. I think that we have very interesting big problems in the U.S. economy right now. Housing is a great example of one. And this is not a pure housing example, but it's like a childcare example that will illuminate where I think a lot of the housing problems are. So D.C. recently passed a law/regulation, because D.C. is kind of weird, that every childcare provider in D.C. must have a bachelor's degree. And all childcare facilities, this was from previously, childcare facilities must be on the first floor. Mind you, many children live in apartments and don't live on the first floor. And there's infinite other regulations. It makes childcare very hard, very expensive. It pushes people onto the gray market, as they call it in the childcare policy world. And so it makes it really hard for parents to make ends meet. So when people talk about nostalgia, for instance, for one-income homes, I actually think that's real, and I don't discount it one bit, that a lot of families would rather have only one parent working so they don't need childcare in the first place, or at least they have that option. And yes, in today's economy, they really don't in the United States. But there's so many reasons for that that have nothing to do with trade. And Donald Trump telling you that there's one quick fix, and it's called tariffs, is missing the whole conversation.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. And Mo, I wanna pick up on one word that Sarah used, which is nostalgia. And because I think it is really important here, not just as we look at export, import, but as we think about the engine of America and industry. I mean, because a lot of the sort of mythology around why tariffs are important is because we are protecting American jobs, and there's, you know, a sense that the left is pushing us into, you know, greener jobs and jobs focused more on protecting the planet that are not those core industries like steel and coal. And like that nostalgic sort of theme feels really important to note here. And until everyone kind of lets go of the nostalgia, if that's all it is, then maybe we're not going to get to real solutions for this economic moment.
Yeah, I mean, I read a story recently. You know, J.D. Vance used to talk about this factory in his hometown that he credited with helping his grandfather get started, if I recall the story correct. That factory in recent years was receiving grants to transition into producing some, you know, cleaner technologies, sort of green jobs, if you want to call them that. And so this administration came in and as part of its efforts with DOGE and setting a different tone on policy, shut down, took the grants away from this factory. The one that J.D. Vance used to tout took grants away from this factory, which is likely going to end up shuttering it. In my mind, manufacturing jobs are manufacturing jobs. If you've got those jobs focusing on different technologies, you're still they're still good paying jobs. And so they're missing the forest through the trees. They are trying to take us back to this era, as Sarah said, of the 1950s when everything was humming and right after the war and people were feeling good and feeling happy. And we were the, you know, strongest economy anywhere because of our manufacturing base. But the world has changed. As Sarah said, right? The world
not just
has
us.
Changed. Everybody has changed. And this is similar to a lot of the anxieties and tensions that we were feeling in this country 100, 120 years ago when the world was changing and we were moving from an agricultural-based economy to an industrial-based economy globally. And a lot of people were freaking out. And you had a lot of sort of populist, isolationist voices in this country saying, we got to go back. We got to go back to the way it was before. And the world can't. We eventually learned how to keep up with it. And that's part of this problem, is they are looking backwards because people are freaking out by a changing world. And rather than saying, let's move forward, they're saying, let's retreat, let's withdraw and look tough doing so. And people are getting hurt in the meantime.
And by the way, keep all of the regulations on housing that makes it really hard to build housing, very expensive to build new housing, the NIMBYs that prevent new housing, all of that, not only coming from the left, but largely coming from the left when you look at states like California, for instance, that are in a housing crisis. A lot of what you hear people talk about is that young people can't afford homes, that you can't afford one income. A lot of this is related to housing. And I would love to see a candidate run on the one quick fix of fixing the housing crisis in the United States by cutting all the red tape so we can build more houses for people.
But we're not talking about those sorts of things, in part because we have a president who I think is doubling down on the kind of nostalgia that we're all talking about. And that is part of his allure, right? I mean, I want to listen to a little bit of Donald Trump as he's talked about tariffs in recent times and ask you both about it.
Foreign scavengers have torn apart our once beautiful American dream. We had an American dream that you don't hear so much about. You did 4 years ago, and you are now, but you don't too often, and for many years and decades even, you didn't hear too much about. Our country and its taxpayers have been ripped off for more than 50 years.
but it is not going to happen anymore. Not going to happen. And today we're standing up for the American worker, and we are finally putting America first.
So what I hear from the president there, I hear that as a form of patriotism. I hear that as a message we could have heard 50 years ago, like protect the American worker from being threatened from outside forces. Well, I mean, that lands with people in this moment, right? And I think that we're not going to get to some of the types of debates that you're talking about, Sarah, if Donald Trump is connecting with a sizable part of this country talking about things like that. And I wonder, even if the tariffs are absolute chaos and markets tumble, and as Mo, you said, and, you know, we do have to follow the polls because if his economic numbers, you know, truly tank, I mean, maybe he changes course, but this is an important part of his message.
This is not landing as well as he thinks it does, though.
That's the question.
A growing number of Americans do not like how this, they do not feel like his current approach, maybe a different approach, but his current approach, they don't feel like is protecting them because they are feeling worse off. And you know what? A lot of the people he's talking about are the ones who are feeling it the most acutely, not just because there's less money in their pockets because prices are going up and their retirement account is smaller, but the farmer who's producing soybeans and his single largest market is China. Right? He's out there today saying, Mr. President, I know you want to look out for me, but get this done quickly because this escalating trade war is, I'm now producing a crop that is likely to not be profitable this year. So I don't see how he is helping the American worker, and I don't think they are either right now.
So a couple things here. One, this goes to my like three steps here. I think Donald Trump has absolutely identified a problem that a lot of Americans feel. That's what's deeply popular about his message, his identification and description of the problem. His diagnosis of the problem, I think, is just wrong. I think it's politically expedient to say, I can flip a switch and fix this problem that's been, you know, going on for 50 years. And then, of course, the actual solution, the switch flipping, is a problem.
You're saying
the diagnosis
he's telling a compelling story about what a lot of Americans are facing.
That might just be true. You know, a lot of people do want to have one income households. They want to own a house. They want what that American dream was. But as Mo said, the world has changed. So Americans today are, by any definition, better off in terms of their purchasing power because of the world economy, that means Nikes get made by someone who makes $6,000 a year. We don't want to do that here for $6,000 a year. That would be a huge mistake. So either you're making $6,000 a year here, or Nikes are five times as much. None of those work particularly well. What Donald Trump has also failed to tell people is that he only has taken into account goods in his tariff world. But America is an exporter of services, and all those countries that are importing our services can really hurt our economy if they suddenly pass laws about not using American services, for instance. Like, the economy is actually pretty complicated. The world economy is very complicated. And Donald Trump hit on a very smart, real problem that a lot of Americans feel. But like Donald Trump, he tells them there's an easy solution that like only idiots don't understand. And, you know, I think people were like, that's great. And that's why his numbers were doing so well. When he implemented his idiot-proof solution, and then it turned out that that was a really bad idea, and then he had to back off of it with getting nothing in the middle part of that, and then claims victory. Like, Americans aren't actually stupid. So I think the problem still exists, which is going to make people even angrier. They still can't buy a house. They still can't afford to have one income and have someone stay home with the kids. So we still have a childcare problem. So we still have a women in the workforce problem. We still have men and boys problem. And we're back to where we were, but maybe worse off.
All right, we're going to take another break and be back and pick up this conversation in just a moment with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're We're back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. And Sarah, you said something as we were going to break that I totally agree with. Americans are not stupid, and no one in politics should think that. And I think back to, and this, you know, is more than a decade ago now, but 3 years reporting in Russia. And Mo, I constantly think about this, like the idea of comparing the United States of 2025 and Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin in Russia. Saying those words is very dangerous. It's triggering. A lot of people will hear that and say, like, oh, you're calling Donald Trump an authoritarian like Putin and so forth. And I get all of that. But I want to dig in a more nuanced way, because I would talk to a lot of Russians in my reporting who were not stupid, as you said, Sarah, who were very, very wise, globally minded, understood the world, knew that Vladimir Putin did very dangerous things, but they were afraid of where the world was going. And they were trying to cling to things that were important to their families, to what they saw as values, and that the way the world was changing was very frightening. And in a very Russian way, their answer to that was to have faith in a leader, even a flawed leader, but a leader who went out there and said, you know, everything is going to be okay. I am fighting for you, even if, you know, they knew that they were hurting. I mean, they could forget about things because in a scary world that they believed in a kind of paternalistic way in a leader. I think there are elements of that in the United States today and in Donald Trump that are just these echoes of when I would listen to Russians talk about that, and I would challenge them and say, like, you know, why do you believe in this person? They would make a pretty compelling case. Is that landing with either of you?
Yeah. And we started talking about this, I think, in the last segment a little bit, right? During times of profound social, cultural, political, and economic upheaval, you see societies, and I think this is true worldwide, and I think this has been true throughout history, begin to sort of cleave into two different camps. Those who say, okay, change is a coming, and we got to keep up with it. And those who say too much too fast, and we've got to hold on to all we have ever known. We have to hold on to the world as we knew it for as long as we can, because there's too much coming too fast. And that does create all these different types of upheaval. It isn't just political. It isn't just economic. It is cultural. It is social. And so I get that, right? Because we have seen it throughout history. But I will say what history has shown us is inevitably, invariably, it is that first camp, the ones who say, let's figure out how to keep pace with it, that end up winning. That we can't hold on to some things. But history is full of political leaders who have risen based on selling people the bill of goods, right? Both Sarah and I have talked about this episode, that it's fine. We can keep things as they were. We can go back to the way they were, even in the face of all this change.
Right.
And it provides some short-term political opportunities for them. But every time, those people have made the world a little bit worse until their inevitable fall.
Sarah, are you taking care of a new kitten?
Yes.
This is a new cat you got after your cat passed?
Yeah, his name is Guac and Chips. Aww. Named by my five-year-old.
Oh, I love that. Well, I'm glad to have Guac and Chips here. Yeah, no, we're happy to have Guac and Chips. You got a lot to say.
You should hear him at 4 a.m.
Well, can I ask you, I just think about the kind of thing that we were talking about, and you keep saying, like, these are not the right things we should be debating if we care about helping the American worker and American families, but this is the political dynamic as Mo just described it, and until someone sort of talks Americans out or many Americans out of that holding on to the past because of fear of a quickly changing world at a very fast pace, I feel like this is where we will have politicians like Donald Trump come and make arguments about things like tariffs in a sort of political, patriotic, I'm going to protect you sort of shroud.
I disagree with a lot of what you just said.
Good.
So I think part of the problem is that nobody has been willing to recognize the actual problem. You know, you're saying that it's fear and they want to go back. Like, no. They have a problem now. And the problem now is something that nobody's recognizing. They're telling them that they're better off, that like, isn't it great that you have these two income families making all this money and that we have childcare? Look at all the childcare available. And what they're saying is, that's not what I want. You're not listening to what I want. You're not recognizing my problem. And it hasn't helped, I think, that in the meantime, while not recognizing the problem, or when they do, they like make fun of the problem, right? Clinging to their guns and religion. Remember that line from President Obama? That hit on this cultural zeitgeist of, you hate us. You don't know what we want. And when we tell you our problem, you think we're stupid and backward and racist and all these other things. At the same time, you had a party of the left, which said America was bad. So for a while, it was, you know, they were like uncomfortable with patriotism and American exceptionalism. Then they went through a, like, actually, America is evil. It's rooted on white supremacy. So like, not only are they not recognizing that you have a real problem, calling you stupid when you talk about your problem, but then they're also saying that the whole country that you believe in is also evil. And that time that you're saying like, hey, look, we had this, like, that's the type of lifestyle that I want. They're saying that's white supremacist and evil. So yeah, that's going to give rise to a lot of anger. And that when someone acknowledges the problem, they're going to be more willing to listen to that person, even if the solutions are actually counterproductive in this
case.
That
literally is not what the left has said about America. That literally is not. The left has been saying, we can recognize that there were a lot of people, that this country's success was, a lot of people whose back the success of this nation has been built on, and try to remedy that. That doesn't make us a terrible country. That doesn't make us, right? And that's what the left has been saying all along. But there are too many people.
No, that's what you've been saying, Mo, because you're wonderful. No. And I...
Well, I'll agree with that, that I'm wonderful. But I do think that, you know, I think there, because of political
expediency... You think the left is totally comfortable with the idea of American exceptionalism.
I think the left, you hear people on the left all the time talking about how much they love this country and that they are just as patriotic. The problem was, we allowed the right for too long, and this is on the left. This is the left's problem, is they allowed the right for too long to define what patriotism meant. But Americans on the left, progressives, have always loved this country, have always believed this is the greatest country in the world. And it is our ability to recognize our mistakes in the past that help add to that greatness. The fact that we're willing to remedy some of these problems of the past and bring those who we left behind along with everybody else is what makes us such a great country, and not something every country does. That is the zeitgeist of the American left. But then we just allowed the American right to say, well, that means you're not patriotic because this is the only definition. And it just bothers me when people say the left does not believe in America's greatness, because we believe, this is one thing we all can agree on and we all do agree on, and that is that America is great.
I think that what you describe is the aspirational and center left of the Democratic Party. I think the progressive movement and a lot of folks in the progressive movement would disagree with you, but rather than argue with you about that, I am curious what your response is to the Obama, they're clinging to their guns and religion when people are describing their problems.
Yeah, no, I've said consistently that I think we did a terrible job over the past several decades on the left of alienating people culturally. I think that's 100% true. But I also think the point you were making, that people heard us say that and said, you don't get me and you don't get what I want, is also what they say when they hear people on the right talk. When they hear people on the right talking about how we need to, you know, when you look at some of the things that they're doing in terms of going into libraries or going in, the culture wars that they run on the right, I think a lot of Americans are saying, that's not what I want you to focus on right now. I also think it's not what a lot of people want when they hear the conservative economic argument of let's cut taxes on the top tier, because that will then trickle down into jobs that they create for the rest of us. And I think the fact that you still hear that being a central part of the conservative economic argument has a lot of people sitting there and saying, that's not what I want either. You're not hearing what my problems are, because we have tried that and it hasn't worked for us. So I think both sides come in with a certain level of ideological and cultural rigidity that most of America sits there and says, you guys aren't listening. And so you can have somebody like Donald Trump coming in and saying something a little bit differently, and they're like, all right, let's give that a shot.
So can I get Mo and David to agree with me that the best thing we can do right now is get rid of all environmental, trade, and union-based regulations on building new and cheaper housing?
I think that's too complicated a question to respond to with just moments left in the show this
week.
Too
complicated a question and too simplistic of an answer. Right?
I actually think it's worth digging into what we think are the actual debates that should be taking place, and let's debate those policies. Because I do think, and this is where I'd like to land, that this question of, like, do we need to resolve some definition of America and American greatness to even come back to the table and debate real solutions?
There has never in our history been a common definition of what makes America great. There has never been, right? I'm going back to the debates between Adams and Jefferson in our first contested presidential election. They had very different ideas of what would make our new republic great.
And that's a good thing, I think. And I guess that's my question. Like, by focusing so much on what makes greatness and what is exceptional, are we actually not digging into the real questions, like regulations on building new housing, Sarah, that you're—
I just want to be clear, Alexis de Tocqueville, I'm not saying he said it made America great, but he did say it made America exceptional, and it was all of our lawyers.
Okay, with that.
He said everything in America eventually turns to litigation. And that was back when he wrote Democracy in America in 1835.
Definitely. We need more lawyers. That's what I'm saying. Okay, before we go to rants and raves, I want all of you to know that we would love to hear your questions, comments that you have for us. We might play them on the air and talk about them. If you've got a question or that you'd like answered on the show, if you could record a voice memo, maybe 30 seconds or so, that's ideal. Send it to us by email, lrc@kcrw.org, lrc@kcrw.org. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and we promise we are reading all of them, and we'll bring some of them onto the show. Okay, we are going to move to our left, right, and center rants and raves for the day. Sarah, with your new kitten from Kuwait, I will let you go first.
Yeah, I'll give a rave about adopting animals here in the United States. There's lots of animals that need your love and that will love you and that will brighten your life. And cats are basically throw pillows that you just, you know, leave some dry food out and some water. They're very, very easy, minus the loud meowing sometimes. Petfinder.com is a great place to find your new fuzzy friend. And when you're binging whatever Netflix show tonight, you can just sit there and scroll through some fuzzy faces, and you can search with how close you need them to you and all of that. And it's pretty great around here.
Love that. Guac and chips. Guac and chips.
We call him guac.
Okay.
But if he's been bad, we call him guacamole.
Guacamole. Oh, that's bad.
That's like, you know, when they're, Sarah Maureen Isger, you come here right now.
Oh, God. Yeah. That just gave me shivers. Yeah. My wife says David Green, it's done. Mo.
Last week, I missed the show because I was at a weekend-long event up in Philadelphia. Now, normally, I don't love the city of brotherly love. It's fine. It's just not my favorite city. But walking around this time hit me very, very differently. And I'm not sure what it was, but I was so keenly aware of the city's role in the birth of the republic that just walking around and feeling the history that was born in that place, really touched me for some reason on this last weekend, and thinking ahead to the fact that we are just a year away from our nation's 250th birthday, I got super pumped. And so I'm raving about Philly. I am raving about the upcoming 250th birthday celebration. And you know why, Sarah? Because I'm patriotic.
Oh, okay. Nice callback. Nice callback.
I love this country.
I'm going to take us from like 50,000 feet view that you just offered, Mo, to like 5 feet on the ground and talk about parking. I am sick and tired of pulling up to a meter or a parking pay machine and it says, if this machine does not work, you can't park here. No. Like, it is not my fault. It is your fault, any city that I'm in, if the machine is inoperable. Fix it, and I can park there until you do. Okay, thank you.
Oh, David, I have a whole great rant, like a legal rant, on the constitutionality of chalking tires, which is often a substitute for broken parking meters.
To see if you've been there for more than 2 hours or whatever.
And whether is that a Fourth Amendment search of your car because they are invading your space by marking your tires. There's a circuit split on this between the courts, and the Supreme Court has yet to resolve it.
This is exactly what de Tocqueville was thinking about, wasn't it, Sarah?
Yes. Yes, he was.
I played right into that. Okay. Thank you, Mo and Sarah. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green with production help from Kelsey Gante. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show's recorded by Sue Margulies and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We're distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. More lawyers in America. That is clearly the solution that we're all looking for. Come back next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.